Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 1164, State v. Demion, arguing for the petitioner, Phyllis Hiranaka, arguing for the respondent, Sonia McCullen, arguing on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? All right, and then my understanding, Ms. Hiranaka, you are reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, is that correct? And we'll give you a warning. And Ms. McCullen, how much time did you want to warn? 10. Okay, so we'll have yellow lights come on at both those points in your arguments. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Phyllis Hironaka on behalf of Philip De Jesus De Leon. Mr. De Leon respectfully requests that this honorable court vacate the ICA's SDO affirming his convictions, remand case for a new trial, and in which, number one, he is permitted to introduce expert testimony regarding cocaine and its effects on the decedent, John Powell, and number two, with corrected and complete self-defense instructions, as explained in our briefs. There is a third issue, which actually, upon reflection, appears to be part and parcel of our first issue, which was requested, this court requested supplemental briefing on, and that is the question of what the standard of admissibility should be or is for expert testimony in criminal cases, whether it should be reasonable probability or reasonable certainty. And Mr. De Leon submits that probability should be the proper standard. Mr. De Leon contends that the ICA gravely erred in denying his ineffective assistance of counsel claim and on the instructional error. In this case, as you well know, it is a murder case, an attempt murder case. There were initially 8 charges against Mr. De Leon, and it's clear from the evidence that was brought forward that self-defense was going to be Mr. De Leon's primary defense. His secondary defense was going to be EMED mitigation. The main hurdle that appears to be in existence for defense and defense counsel was the reasonableness of Mr. De Leon's use of a gun. The facts known to Mr. De Leon at the time of the incident were that there were 4+ large men on one, that there was a prior incident, where the group was generally, had animosity towards Mr. De Leon, and he was by himself. The group was kind of acting as a gang. It was all as a group, and I use that term very loosely. There was possibly a bit of racial animus, local versus mainland Mexican. And Powell, the gentleman who was ultimately shot and killed, was the alpha male of that group. It appeared from the testimony as far as, where they went, what they did, when they stayed, when they left, everything revolved around Mr. Powell, who was being driven around by Justin Gamboa, who was one of the other gentlemen. All of the people in Powell's party were very drunk. It appears that Powell was also possibly high on cocaine, and that's one of the issues here. And that at the moment before the shooting, Powell is the man leading his group of 3 or 4 other men towards the defendant. They're swearing and yelling, so this is not a pleasant encounter. And Powell had reached to within an arm's length of De Leon before Mr. De Leon fired. The witness statements say that Mr. De Leon fired warning shots. It differs as to whether it was in the air or whether it was in the ground, but that there were shots fired before the fatal shot. There was also testimony that the shots fired in the ground were to scare off the other approaching men. Facts revealed and confirmed by discovery were that Powell was shot at close range and that there were both alcohol and cocaine in Powell's blood. The main problem with the evidence coming out or not coming out, and this is where the ineffective assistance issue started, was that counsel was prohibited from bringing out any evidence that Mr. Powell had cocaine in his blood. Zero evidence. And as I look at the progress of the testimony, counsel for the state clearly had that in mind, that they they wanted to preclude the use of the cocaine evidence. There were motions of limine that were filed that the state asked for it to be precluded. The trial court thought about it and had a hearing on September 3rd, at which she said, based on the August 9 letter that defense expert Clifford Wong had submitted, that it was too inconclusive, too speculative. Subsequent to that, on September 7th, Dr. Wong submitted a follow-up letter where he said basically that his opinion was to a reasonable probability that Mr. Paul was affected by cocaine at the time, as well as alcohol. Then there was a further hearing on the 10th, I believe, of September, and finally a 104 hearing on September 22 during defense case. And ultimately, no mention of the cocaine was made during the trial.
Did the defendant appeal the actual ruling precluding the introduction of the cocaine evidence as opposed to raising the ineffective assistance of counsel claim? And if not, why not?
Okay, this case has taken, for me, as the, both as the appellate counsel and now arguing before this court and having prepared the supplemental briefs, it's taken many different turns. And at the time that I was drafting the opening brief, it appeared to me that the court had a basis to deny it based on the lack of reliability or speculativeness. And the problem that I found with that is that the only way that that information could have been brought before or should have been brought before the trial court with more, power, I guess, I can't think of another word, but basically more convincing information would have been to have had the 104 hearing earlier. Now, in discussions about this case with my appellate section, there are other possibilities. For example, I think he did subpoena Dr. Goodhue, who was the acting medical examiner at the time and actually did the autopsy on Mr. Powell, in the defense case, to be able to testify that there was X amount of cocaine found in his blood. And as I look at it at this point in time, when we're at the Supreme Court doing oral arguments, it appears that it may be a confluence of both trial court and trial counsel error. And I don't know how to, I'm not really trying to assign blame on one more than the other. But
well, how did trial counsel error?
My initial thought was trial counsel failed to substantiate the cocaine evidence with, because at the 104 hearing on the 22nd, the judge asked specifically, just before the end of the direct of Dr. Wong, well, I'm still waiting to hear the numbers and the effect. So there was discussion about retrograde cocaine extrapolations that Dr. Wong apparently did. And the court obviously is waiting to hear that information before it could decide on whether the information was reliable enough, et cetera. So based on, and counsel said, I'm getting there in 5 more minutes, and it never happened. And so that was my initial focus when I looked at the way the trial proceeded, the way the evidence was brought to the court's attention.
But he does elicit testimony, yes, as to the effect.
I'm sorry?
The defense counsel did elicit testimony from the doctor as to the effect.
Yes, that's true. And I'm not sure if it did not appear very strong, because Dr. Wong was cross-examined very thoroughly by the prosecutor, who poked a number of holes into his conclusions, et cetera. And I think that swayed the court. But the bottom line, and this...
Well, Ms. Hironaka, try to speak into the mic. We are recording the proceeding.
But this goes into what this court had asked for supplemental briefing on, which is whether the standard should be reasonable certainty or reasonable probability with regard to the admission of evidence. Because under 702, it's kind of it just says that the touchstones, this is under Vliet, from Vliet, touchstones of admissibility for expert testimony on HRV 702 are relevance and reliability. Now, clearly, whether Mr. Powell was affected by cocaine or not is relevant. Reliability was, I think, where the court got hung up. And in determining the reliability of the information that she had heard, she determined that it was too speculative. And that's where the supplemental briefing ties in with our first issue, which is the ineffective assistance of counsel and or the trial court error.
Now, in response to Justice McKenna's question, where she asked where does the ineffectiveness occur, and your response, this is the question that was asked mm-hmm. by defense counsel, by alcohol and cocaine, and you measure the level of cocaine right. You extrapolated that. Yes. Question. The combined effect of alcohol and cocaine would be additive in their diminution effect on critical judgment and caution. Yes.
Correct.
I'm not sure I see any ineffectiveness of defense counsel.
Understood.
So if he did not appeal the denial, refusal of this evidence, then are you asking this court to exercise a plain error review?
Well, as I said, when I raised the ineffective assistance, it was specifically as to the cocaine error. And so that's where my focus was. But yeah, if it's going to be more a focus of trial court error, then it would have to be by plain error, because you're correct that I did not.
What constitutional rights is implicated, or what substantial rights are implicated?
Basically, his right to due process and fair trial. The bottom line is that the jury did not get to hear that Mr. Powell had both cocaine and alcohol in his system at the time of the shooting. And it's really clear from the medical examiner's report that they found both cocaine and alcohol. And then in Dr. Wong's subsequent testimony, he explained about there were actually four different substances that he discussed. One was the alcohol, one was the 0.05 milligrams of cocaine, then there was the benzolecanine, I'm assuming that's the right pronunciation, which he said was a metabolite of cocaine. And so that meant that it had been in the system for a while. And then finally was the cocaethylene, which is the product Dr. Wong explained when cocaine and alcohol are simultaneously taken at the same time. And Dr. Wong stated in his testimony, I believe at the 104 hearing, that cocaethylene has its own effects, causes its own version of euphoria. So in addition to the cocaine and the alcohol, the cocaethylene added yet another layer of high onto Mr. Powell. And so then the question becomes, what was his ability to perceive? Was his judgment affected? Defense for De Leon definitely believes that the jury was entitled to hear and consider that information.
What about the argument that it's harmless because the jury was informed of the effects of the alcohol, that he was apparently very profoundly under the influence?
The response would be that because the cocaine clearly was simultaneously consumed, and there was the cocaethylene as well, that, as I said, was an additional layer, an additional substance that affected his ability, judgment, thinking, etc. And so, actually, the jury was only told about the alcohol when there were two other substances that were affecting his perception, his cognition, his movement and actions, etc.
But the defense was allowed to make the point that this individual was profoundly under the influence of alcohol, and that could have affected him in a way that made him aggressive. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct. They were able to bring out the alcohol.
So how would the lack of the cocaine, what would the effect on the trial be of not having the additional information? The jury had the argument that the defendant was under the influence of alcohol and as a result could be acting in sort of a belligerent and aggressive manner. What was the harm in not having an additional pharmacological basis for that testimony?
Dr. Wong's testimony at the 104 hearing had that second September 7th letter, and he said that the additional information that he received between the time he wrote the August 9 letter, where he said, I don't have enough information to make a good decision on it, to I have additional information and now I have an opinion, was that he viewed the video of the shooting, and it was a surveillance video of very poor quality, where in the screen they were in a teeny portion of the upper left hand corner, so you can see movement, but it's very difficult to see people or anything as distinctive as, say, hand movements, etc. So he got to see that, but he said that the second piece of information that he got, which I think was critical to his opinion, was was that he learned of the cocaethylene. And that was where...
Although he said he wasn't relying on cocaethylene alone, right? In his opinion.
Not alone. But all those three substances in combination.
So cocaethylene would just be the fact that there was a combination of alcohol and cocaine in found in the decedent's blood, I guess.
It only is, according to Dr. Wong, it only is found when they are taken simultaneously. But he also reported that cocaethylene has its own euphoric, if you will, effects or high effects. Intoxicating effects. I can't think of a better word for that.
Well, he testified cocaine in combination with alcohol would have an additive effect.
That's
right?
Correct.
So which would heighten the impact of the alcohol terms of, I suppose, behavior.
Correct. So the jury only heard that Mr. Powell was affected by the alcohol and did not get to hear that he also had the additive cocaine and the additive cocaine. So I...
Well, the state argues that this was all speculation and it wasn't reliable information that the doctor had. How do you answer that?
Defense would answer it that it's within his kuleana, if you will. It's within his experience. He's a toxicologist. He studied the effects of different substances, whether it's poisons, I think he called them, whether it's narcotics or stimulants or just over, you know, prescribed drugs, etc., on the human body. That's his study. And so he was able to make an opinion, and he was qualified to give an opinion that the substances affected Mr. Powell or affect people. And so I think that it's not speculative that he was able to speak to that. Again, in the supplemental briefing, when we talked about whether the standard should be reasonable certainty or reasonable probability, basically, all the cases that I could find had to do with, let the prior fact give the weight to which the experts opine, and that it should not be withheld from the jury because it needs certainty. Because I think there's a quote in there that said, if somebody who's going to wait for certainty, since scientific hypotheses are always changing, will possibly live forever.
But you're advocating today a probability standard.
Yes.
What's your definition of probability?
That's very difficult to because as you saw from my supplemental brief, the courts that of the cases that I cited had all sorts of different explanations for definitions for what probability was.
Because probability could be just 51%, right?
That's correct.
And so that would mean any opinion that an expert rendered would probably not be rendered unless it was probable, because you wouldn't say your opinion unless you believe it more than 50%. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how much helpfulness a reasonable probability is, and maybe that's why many states and federal jurisdictions don't even imply that.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that under the circumstances of this case, it appears that a reasonable probability is the correct standard, because we will never know for certain. I think in the studies that were discussed in the transcripts, no scientist or forensic pathologist who studies these substances, unless they're doing a clinical, like a closed clinical study, where they can control for, you know, who the people are, they can test their blood, they can test their, you know, heart rate and all those different things that they were talking about, can determine what amounts of cocaine affect a person and for how long. In the forensic situation where there's somebody examining somebody who's died or somebody who's been badly injured in an accident, they never see how much the person has. They only know how much is left over in the bloodstream. And so we're never going to get the certainty that the court was requiring in this case.
Are you arguing that reasonable... I'm assuming that you're arguing that in the context of this case, where this is a defense of self-defense, mm-hmm. and the issue is the reasonableness of your client's apprehension.
Correct.
Then a reasonable scientific probability standard should be employed as to whether or not the cocaine evidence should have been admitted. But I'm assuming you're not arguing that that would also, that would, that this standard would apply in, for all scientific evidence in all criminal cases, especially with respect to the, where the state may have the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt a certain attendant circumstance that required proof
that's
beyond
correct.
A reasonable doubt, such
that's
as
correct.
Blood alcohol level or something of that nature.
Because I can really only argue about the facts of this case, and those other cases have to be left for another day.
The doctor said he needed information about when the cocaine was taken and the amount of cocaine taken. So, and he never got that information.
No.
So how could he arrive at a determination that there was, that arrive at an opinion based on reasonable scientific probability?
What he did was he went about it in a different way, which is that based on the half-life of cocaine, which I believe he said is something like 1 to 1.5 hours or half an hour to 1 hour, something like that. It was a very short amount of time that he did a calculation or extrapolation based on that information. And looking at the amounts of cocaine that were remaining in Powell's blood, he was able to make a calculation based on what he knew about the half-life of cocaine.
But how could he know that, how would he know whether Mr. Powell took a very large amount of cocaine early in the evening and that then degraded over a long period of time and he was no longer under the influence? In other words, he could have taken a huge amount at 8 o'clock and the half, given the half-life by the time it got to 4 in the morning, could be the amount that was there. Alternatively, he could have taken a much smaller amount like half an hour before. And that isn't the problem, that Dr. Wong just didn't know which of those two things it was.
That's correct. And that is something that he'll never be able to know. I mean, number one, because Paul is deceased, but number two, I think that kind of information from, you know, witnesses in a case, you know, is, it's never really going to be forthcoming.
How could he even say by a probability that he was under the influence? That, given that he really just, he, it would just be speculating to know whether or to understand whether it was the former situation I posited or the latter.
Well, he based his opinion on having watched the video and also on the information about the cocaethylene, in addition to what he already had, because I think he read some witness reports as to what happened.
And the cocaethylene meant that he took the cocaine at the same time he was drinking, or after, correct?
Right.
And the evidence suggested he might have started drinking as early as 7:45.
Correct.
So he could have taken a very large dose of cocaine at 8 o'clock, and that high could have dissipated hours before, and he could have had no effect on him whatsoever. You cannot exclude that possibility.
Yeah. Correct. And he also said that there's also there's an initial up period, if you will, and then there's also a withdrawalish kind of period. That was also in his testimony. And so he did not testify as to, well, he testified in the sort of going up.
He didn't testify that a person in the down would be aggressive and hostile, right?
Correct.
He didn't really say what happens.
Right. He wasn't asked that question, but he did testify that there was like a period of going up and a period of coming down, and that basically the person is being influenced by the cocaine in either of those situations. But again, it's...
How could he even say it was probable, though? I guess that's what I'm getting at. How could he say within a reasonable degree of medical probability that this person was under the influence?
I mean, all I have is his testimony, and based upon the items that he looked at, the reports that he considered, his knowledge of the effect of the three substances, the alcohol, the cocaine, and the cocaethylene, his calculation with the half-life, which I frankly can't understand because I don't do math so well, but all of those things, I think it was within his ken to be able to say, I've studied this all my life, and I am making a reasoned scientific opinion that he was under the influence, or he was affected by these substances at the time of the shooting.
I didn't look at the record specifically, but were you allowed to give a manslaughter, or did you get a manslaughter instruction in the
case?
There
was a manslaughter.
Okay. And with respect to the argument about the instruction. The state says, well, the language you wanted included in the self-defense instruction comes from an instruction having to do with when deadly force is not used, and in this case, deadly force was used.
That's correct.
So that's the state's argument is, therefore, the language you wanted in the self-defense instruction about estimating the necessity of use of force is not required in the self-defense instruction. What's your response?
My response to that is that when you look at 703.304, it's broken down into six sections, one through six, and the section that that De Leon is saying needed to have been in there is under subsection three. First of all, the language reads that a person employing protective force may estimate the necessity thereof. So it doesn't say deadly force or just force. It says protective force, which indicates to, you know, by a plain reading that it applies to the use of force and self-protection, regardless of whether it's deadly force or just non-deadly force. Protective force. And then the other thing is that subsection 4 is specific to the use of force. The subsection 5 is specific to the use of deadly force, as is subsection 2. And subsection 3 is not subsumed, or that language is not contained in either, in any of those subsections. And the argument would be that if the drafters thought that it applied only to one or the other and not both, that subsection 3 would have been contained in one of those paragraphs dealing specifically with either the use of force or deadly force. So my contention with the current HOGIC instructions, while it is an improvement clearly over the 7.01, which was repealed and replaced, that it is still incomplete because of that omission of the language of 703.304.3 from the deadly force. And there should be no reason why, you know, in a situation like that where somebody's being approached and they're using self-defense, that they should not be allowed to estimate the necessity thereof. I mean,
how do you distinguish this instruction from the instruction, the similar instruction that was given in Augustine and approved by the school?
In the instruction that was given by, say that again, please?
Augustine, State versus Augustine.
Augustine, I think, went to, excuse me, let me see if I can find that. It's talking about reasonably believe such force is immediately necessary. And De Leon's position is that that language cannot be equated with the language about a person employing protective force may estimate the necessity thereof under the circumstances as he believes them to be. Because the use of force is justified, I'm going back to the previous one, use of force is justified when a person reasonably believes such force is immediately necessary to protect him or herself on the present occasion against use of unlawful force by the other person. I would contrast that with estimating the necessity thereof to be more like interpreting whether you need one blow or three to ward off the attacker, whether you should hit harder or softer, whether you should use a gun versus a stick versus your fist.
Now, didn't Augustine basically say the same language that you're challenging in this instruction? It appeared to approve that language. I guess that's Justice McKenna's question. How would you, are you advocating we overrule Augustine? Or?
Oh, no. Just that additional language from 304.3 be added in there.
But the section that you're relying on to estimate the necessity, it references retreating. And there's no requirement of retreating in non-deadly force. And furthermore, isn't there a big difference when you're talking about, let me just finish, when you're estimating the necessity, if you're using non-deadly force and you make a mistake about estimating the necessity, mm-hmm. Well, the person's alive. But if you make a mistake about estimating the necessity with deadly force, and you're wrong, are you preventing a greater evil, or are you creating a greater evil by allowing self-defense in that circumstance? And that's, isn't that the basis for the distinction that the model penal code is based on?
I really can't speak for what the model penal code, I didn't research into that area, and I think you ask a very important question there. I'm just looking at the language that is contained in the statutes that we have and applying it as it appears to be relevant to the case at hand.
But you're making that term without retreating mean nugatory. I mean, and we don't do that.
Well,
the
retreat language, as I read it in the statute, had to, I think there's a qualifier that says that you have to be able to retreat with complete safety.
But that applies to deadly force. It's not a non-deadly force requirement.
Ms. Hironaka, perhaps you could address this during your rebuttal. I will give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. If you'd like, perhaps you could be reviewing it and then you could mention it then if you'd like, or if you're ready to go ahead, can answer now.
No, I do see that my time is up. So
I will give you some time for rebuttal because we've been asking questions during the time you'd reserved. So, Ms. McCullen.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. In addressing this Court's concern regarding the degree of certainty required, the plain language of Rule 702 doesn't require a degree of certainty for admission of scientific expert testimony. Admissibility instead requires relevancy and reliability. And here, the trial court did make a ruling on reliability in terms of Dr. Wong's cocaine testimony. The court initially stated that because there was variables Dr. Wong needed from his first letter to his second letter, and he didn't receive those variables or specific information.
But he did receive additional information, right?
He did. The first piece of information Dr. Wong testified to was the video. He viewed the video. And in viewing the video, though, Dr. Wong explained to the court that he could not see behavioral clues such as pupil dilation, antsiness, tremors, indications that someone is under the influence of cocaine. And so regarding the video, he wasn't able to connect what he saw in the video to effects of cocaine. Dr. Wong also testified that there was no kind of correlating chart like that of alcohol where he was
able
to-
What else had he received in the interim?
The coca, I don't know how to say it, coca let. He received that, and basically that showed that cocaine and alcohol were ingested at around the same time. But he was still not able to lay a foundation for the additive effects of cocaine to alcohol.
But he did testify that based on a reasonable scientific probability, Mr. Powell was under the influence of cocaine also.
He did, yes. He stated that he did testify to that.
And the basis of the trial court's decision to refuse this evidence was not based on reliability, but based on, well, reliability in the sense that Dr. Wong was not able to testify in his opinion based on a reasonable scientific certainty.
Well, first the court explains that, or bases her opinion, its opinion on reliability and confusion to the jury, and explains why, because of the missing variables. And then the court states, and further, Dr. Wong couldn't testify to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. So I think those two reasons could be mutually exclusive. She wasn't necessarily relying on just one.
But there were different times during the questioning. For example, the court interjected at one point, actually interjected scientific certainty during the questioning, and then again during her ruling at several points referred to scientific certainty. So it would appear that the court thought that was a standard, and in fact thought that she was that the judge thought that she was applying that standard. Wouldn't you agree?
It sounds like the judge was relying somewhat on, yes, I would, on scientific certainty.
And if that's true, why? How can we have confidence that she would have reached the same outcome had she been applying the right standard?
I think because of all the other factors in terms of reliability, Dr. Wong's, the basis for Dr. Wong's opinion, he first testified that he didn't have all the variables he needed or information. He couldn't connect what, even without the variables, he came out with a number, a range of possible amount of cocaine in Powell's blood at the time of the shooting. And even if we took that amount, he couldn't really correlate that amount to a behavior. He attempted to do it through the video, but he couldn't see any behavioral clues.
I think he did see behavioral clues. He said, if you watch the tape, there's only one person who doesn't run.
He says there's only one person who doesn't run, but
he attributes it to a possible cocaine use, does he not?
He says insofar as no one else took cocaine that night, but there's no evidence that anyone else took or didn't take cocaine that night. And he also testified that victim was just standing in front of defendant. There was no indication of lunging or attacking. Dr. Wong also...
When he talked about cocaine factors, did he say that one tends to lunge? I thought it was more of a euphoric or, stand your ground kind of effect.
He's also... using it to show that there's aggressiveness, but yet he didn't testify to any visual clues of aggressiveness. Victims just approaching, and it wasn't just victim approaching. It looks like others were approaching also, and the testimony shows that at least Jermaine was approaching, and the others kind of turned and walked that way, and once the shots were fired, the others started to run. But we need to keep in mind, too, that this happened all within an 18, 19-second time frame.
Does that make a difference?
Well, it's happening fast. So, and I believe it's Jermaine's testimony that Powell was about to turn, which could be supported by the medical examiner's testimony that the shot wasn't head-on, but was kind of at an angle.
The court says it's going to rely on its prior ruling and exclude the evidence because the doctor didn't receive the information he said he needed previously, which was the time at which the cocaine was taken and the amount of cocaine taken. And the court applies a standard of reasonable scientific certainty to that. So doesn't the doctor say, I would need that information if I had to render an opinion based on reasonable scientific certainty, but not if I'm basing my opinion on reasonable scientific probability?
I think he says to make a more definitive.
He does render an opinion, right?
Yes.
He says, in my opinion, based on reasonable scientific probability, the cocaine had an impact on Mr. Powell's behavior.
In the first letter?
No, in his testimony.
Yes.
So, in effect, if the proper standard is reasonable scientific probability, then his testimony would meet that standard, wouldn't it?
If the standard is...
Even if he did not have. If he can render an opinion based on reasonable scientific probability without the information that he had earlier required, and the fact that he later looked at the video and got information that there was cocaethylene in the victim's body, wouldn't that be sufficient then for him to arrive at an opinion based on scientific probability as opposed to certainty?
Yes, he could render an opinion. He did render an opinion.
So why is that opinion kept from the jury?
The court believed it was not sufficiently reliable and would confuse the jury. Now, whether she was relying on certainty at the time to support that decision, it's not clear from the record. Her ruling makes it seem as if it was additional and mutually exclusive from her her not sufficient reliability ruling. And her not sufficient reliability ruling was based on not having the additional information, and the information he did receive didn't...
What would the court have to look for to establish a threshold for reliable opinion?
It's supposed to look at the scientific method used to arrive at the opinion and whether it's valid. It looks at whether sufficient data and facts were provided or given. It looks at the principles and methods, and how the witness is applying those principles and methods. And in this case,
An acceptable method in terms of, he's a forensic, toxicologist, and so were the methods he used or employed the kinds that experts in the field would use?
I think so. It looks like he used different methods. The first method was the extrapolation, and the extrapolation, I would say that, yeah, I would have no... disagreement with that method. However, he was missing information to apply that method, according to his testimony. The other method he attempted to use was DRE programs, but he needs visual indication of defendant's behavior, and he couldn't really see that from the video. Like, in his testimony, he says antsiness, tremors, pupil dilation, and that wasn't evident. So he's missing those kinds of variables. He also attempted to apply the theory that cocaine, when added to alcohol, has an additive effect. It makes the effects of alcohol. And alcohol is
a... Are you contesting that? I didn't see any cross-examination or dispute as to the additive effect.
Well, there was, because the state was cross-examining the witnesses, the basis of that testimony, and the basis of that testimony, or that opinion, that the two are added, or the cocaine is additive, came from a McCann-Katz article, which the witness admitted to not reading.
Which was cited by an article that he had read, right?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Well, I thought he was quite familiar with one of the two articles, or one of the articles cited the other article.
In the September 7th letter, he specifically cited the McCann-Katz article for the additive effect, and that's where that information comes from. But he didn't read that article.
But it was included in another article that
he did read. It was included in another article.
And can experts rely on hearsay When it's, can experts rely on hearsay information when it's reasonable for them to do so?
So if you read the Eisenschmidt article, which referred to the Nance or Kant's article, but he didn't read the article referred to, what would be the basis for excluding his opinion based on the Eisenschmidt article?
Well, the Eisenschmidt article actually made two references to the McCants-Katz article regarding the additive effects. But what, and the Eisenschmidt article went through pretty much the whole history of cocaine, and
the state's not
ultimately,
arguing. I'm sorry.
Oh,
go ahead.
Ultimately, the article looked at the effects of cocaine on driving. Driving's not an issue here, but its ultimate conclusion regarding the driving was that the current data suggests that it's very difficult to predict driving impairment on the basis of the presence of cocaine and or metabolites. And I looked at metabolites and includes alcohol. And so that article couldn't even really predict impairment. And so I think there is a problem with the basis. I mean, I'm not saying
that article did not discuss any sort, any type of impairment.
I beg your pardon?
The article did not discuss any impairment from cocaine use?
No, it does discuss some, yes.
What kind of impairment did the article discuss?
The euphoria effect, not maybe not necessarily impairment, but euphoria, the feel good of cocaine. So it does discuss that.
And that is the issue that Dr. Wong testified to, the euphoric effect of cocaine use.
Yes. And as you know, and even if the court did err in excluding the information, the cocaine testimony, the cocaine testimony is relevant to the the justification defense. And in this case, the justification defense, there was no basis for the jury to apply the justification defense in this case because there was no testimony of defendant's reasonable belief, his belief that deadly force was necessary for his protection.
Because the defendant didn't testify?
That could be one reason, but the circumstantial evidence, the evidence from testimonies from everyone else in the video, none of that shows defendant's belief either.
Not even circumstantially. No reasonable inference.
Jermaine testified that victim walked towards defendant but wasn't mad, all testified that they hear a defendant calling out to them.
Was the video seen by the jury?
Yes.
Wasn't the defendant attacked earlier in the evening and it appeared somewhat unprovoked by these same group of people or one of the group of people?
According to the testimony, it looked like defendant and victim were kind of in a tussle, defendant was actually attacked or slapped by someone else, not victim.
Well, it was one,
one
of, the,
of the members of
it
the group.
It was one of
the
yes.
members of the group, yes. But that happened earlier in the night. And so that went back to Justice McKenna's question. Jermaine testified that he heard yelling. They turned around, victim walked towards defendant, but he wasn't mad. His hands were down and he kept saying everything's cool, no more problems. Justin testified that he heard someone yelling.
These are all his friends, aren't they?
These are all the friends. This is the testimony, this is the evidence that was presented to the jury, yes.
But your argument is that it's harmless. If there was error by the court, it's harmless,
yes.
Is that it?
It would have been harmless. Even if the cocaine testimony was admitted, there was no evidence that a victim was aggressive or violent at the time deadly force was used.
Which group approached which person? Can you remind me?
Which group?
Didn't this group approach the defendant?
According to the testimony, defendant called out. One person testifies that we walked towards, another person testifies, I think it's Justin, that they walked towards each other. I think Lane also testified that they walked towards each other. And the video At one point, I believe the defendant is kind of out of frame, and you see him later in frame, so that might indicate he was walking towards them too.
Going back to the scientific stuff for a while, didn't the expert, or Dr. Wong, say that he could testify as a general matter that cocaine use would affect behavior?
Yes, he did.
So isn't that information that would be relevant to this case? And you can argue that issue, but wouldn't it be relevant to this case?
It would be relevant to show or to support evidence that the victim was aggressive or violent, but there's, again, no evidence that was presented to the jury that victim was aggressive or violent. So in that respect, it wouldn't be relevant.
Well, whether he was aggressive or relevant would be something you would have to argue to the jury in terms of inferences from the contact between the groups earlier in the day, right? Because wasn't De Leon's, didn't one of the, I forget his name, starts with a B, slap De Leon's head?
Baldwin, Jermaine Baldwin slapped his head, yes.
Right, and didn't one of the other people say they wanted to false crack De Leon?
Joe Chang testified that Baldwin had stated that prior to doing it.
And Chang then told them to leave and told De Leon, you better get out of here because there might be trouble, or it's to that effect?
Yes.
And so wasn't there evidence from which a jury could infer that the group clearly didn't like De Leon, and that for De Leon's own safety, Joe Chang, who was with that group, told De Leon he better leave?
Yes.
So wouldn't De Leon then have a reasonable belief that his life might be in danger?
Not at the time he used deadly force. That was at the bar earlier in the evening. When he used deadly force, the facts and circumstances surrounding the use of deadly force at that time did not indicate violence or aggressive behavior by the victim, Powell.
Well, he did show up in the parking lot, but everybody left the area, the victim kept walking towards, I guess, De Leon. So when De Leon shot, the victim was within 1 or 1.5 feet?
One testimony was arm's length, one was 3 feet.
It was testimony 1 and 1.5 feet?
I recall arm's length and 3 feet.
I wanted to ask you, why shouldn't a self-defense instruction include within it the fact that a defendant may estimate the necessity for the use of force under the circumstances as he reasonably believes them to be? It would seem that that should be something the jury should consider, shouldn't it, in determining whether the defendant was reasonable in the use of force?
Well, Section 2 of the statute requires not estimating. It requires that the defendant believe deadly force is necessary for his protection against death or serious bodily injury. It doesn't require, for deadly force, he has to believe it's necessary.
But subsection 3 doesn't say except as otherwise provided in subsection 2. It says except as otherwise provided in subsections 4 and 5.
Correct. It doesn't.
It doesn't exclude 2.
It doesn't exclude 2. But I think they're two different standards, or two. One allows the defendant to determine what force is necessary. The other one only allows deadly force if you believe, if the actor believes they're in danger of death or serious bodily injury. And Section 3 does exclude Section 5, which applies to deadly force.
So did the instruction include 5?
Yes, I believe so.
So the jury was instructed that the use of deadly force is not justifiable if the actor knows that he can avoid the necessity by using such
yes.
force with complete safety by retreating. But the jury was not instructed that it was the portion about estimate the necessity of error.
Correct. So again, the state's position is that in terms of this court's request for supplemental briefing, a specific degree of certainty is not required for the admissibility of evidence and that it would go to weight. Again, the state...
So if De Leon were confronted with someone who was walking towards him, even though De Leon was armed and everyone else was walking away, and he had been physically assaulted by the same group hours before. And at the time De Leon shot Powell, Powell was 1.5 feet away, 1 to 2 feet away from him. Wouldn't De Leon then be in imminent danger, maybe of serious bodily injury, based on what had occurred before?
No, I don't think that's evidence of his subjective belief.
So if De Leon is armed with a gun, everybody walks away, but Powell keeps walking towards him, and De Leon waits until Powell is 1 to 2 feet away from him before he shoots him. You think De Leon, you could infer from that, or a jury might infer from that, that at that point, because Powell was so close to him, even though De Leon was armed, that he had a reasonable apprehension of being in danger of serious bodily injury?
No, the testimony is De Leon was standing there. De Leon was saying, no worries, no problem, everything's cool.
You mean Powell?
Powell was standing there, everything's cool, no worries, no problem. I don't think when looking at the evidence that's presented to the jury, that there is a evidence of subjective belief of deadly force was necessary.
Wasn't there also testimony that there was yelling going on outside? I think the person from the bar testified that there were raised voices.
The bar employee testified that at least two voices were yelling. However, he could only recognize bad words, and he his first language was in English. And he didn't go out to see, he didn't know who was yelling at who. that was his testimony.
But a jury could rely on that testimony and discredit or discount the testimony of the witnesses who were out in the parking lot, that everything was cool.
The jury could use it, yes. But again, that witness didn't see if it was Powell who was yelling the bad words. And according to those who did see, Powell was either hands up or to his side and was saying, it's cool, no worries. But this has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. Ms. Hironaka, your rebuttal. And I think if you could wrap up in about 3 minutes, would that be enough time
sure.
for you?
Sure. While it's still fresh in my mind, I wanted to rebut some of the things that counsel for the state had said, which is that one of the things that Dr. Wong had testified to is that cocaine or cocaethylene gives you, he described it as a Superman, an invincible kind of feeling, which would play into that notion that Powell even, would overlook danger, a gun, right in his face, etc. I think Justice Acoba said it was Bowden or Bowdoin who did slap De Leon for no apparent reason in the club a couple of hours before, and he had made a comment to another friend of theirs, Jay Yoshimura, I'm going to go slap that guy, and that's when Chang stepped in and said, don't do that, he's an okay guy, leave him alone. With regard to voices yelling and screaming at the Seoul Karaoke parking lot, Jaekum Kim, who was the employee, did not want to go outside and see, but he said as soon as the group of Powell's gang left his establishment, he said he could hear voices outside, and they were angry voices. They were yelling, they were swearing, and he said he heard two males in particular yelling and swearing at each other. So I know the state had said that perhaps it wasn't you know, Mr. Powell that was doing the yelling and the swearing, there was a confrontation. I think there's no doubt that there was a confrontation outside and that it wasn't friendly. And so since Powell was with the group that was confronting De Leon, it appears reasonable that he and his group were not friendly and doing the hey, it's okay kind of thing. With regard to the question about who approached who, the video shows that there are 4 or 5 guys that exit the Seoul karaoke and head towards where the navigator is parked. And then they all turn and they start walking back towards the Donghua Shopping Center, which is where Seoul karaoke is part of that. And so that's when the confrontation occurs and the shooting. So they were actually on their way, and I think even Gamboa or something testified that he had already opened the door to the car because he was a driver and was ready to get in when this yelling, shouting business goes on. And so they all turned and they walked completely back towards, because the navigator was parked facing, let's say, you folks, and then the old car was parked behind, if you will. And so they turned completely around and walked the other way. And then just a comment that, you know, cocaine use or any of these substances that people take, they clearly take it for the effect that it gives them. It's not just, for no reason at all. They wouldn't take it otherwise. And finally, returning to the very last question, which was the most difficult one, looking at subsection 5, I can only see that it says deadly force is not justifiable under this section if under B, the actor knows he can avoid the necessity of using such force with complete safety by retreating. I thought I'd seen it twice within 703.304, but that is the only place that I can locate it. And the only response that I have to the court's question, Justice Pollack, is that, you know, section 3, it is what it is. It's there, and it doesn't reference the other sections. And so the only takeaway that I can give from that I can get from that is that it was meant to apply to both of them. As far as reading into whether that gives somebody a chance for, like, you know, to use deadly force when if they make a mistake or whatever, I think that's actually where the jury's coming in deciding, whether the use of the force was reasonable or not. But I can't answer that question, obviously, your side of that. But in closing, anyway, I would like to, again, respectfully request that this court vacate the ICH SCO and grant a new trial with the expert testimony, the corrected and complete self-defense instruction, and possibly a ruling that the expert testimony should be admitted if it's a reasonable probability in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.